Welcome to Fertility Friendly Food. I'm your host, Stephanie Velarkis, accredited practicing dietitian and nutritionist and director of The Dietologist, an Australian-based practice focused on optimizing fertility through nutrition. This podcast will bring you snack-size episodes for you to learn, grow, and be inspired by the latest research, facts, and practical lifestyle tips about eating well for optimal fertility, helping you cut through the confusion and myths to take back some of the control on your fertility journey, one bite at a time. Hey everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Fertility Friendly Food, the podcast. My name is Stephanie, and I'm an expert fertility dietitian and nutritionist and founder of The Dietologist. And today I'm really excited to have Kristen Jones, who is an experienced embryologist with her master's degree in reproductive medicine, and she also has a fertility coaching certification, joining us to talk all things egg quality, sperm quality, egg counts, and just all the nitty-gritty questions that I get about the world of fertility treatments and IVF. And I'm really excited to pick her brains today. So thanks so much for joining us, Kristen. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, before we get into the nitty-gritty questions, can you tell us a bit about who you are and what you do?
Yep, so I'm an embryologist, so I'm the scientist behind the scenes in an IVF lab, and I'm also a mum of two little kids, so I work part-time. So because I had my own struggles to conceive, I became really passionate about helping guide people and educating them about what it's kind of like to go through fertility struggles and fertility treatment. So that's why I created my Instagram page. So that's just a little kind of side job that I do to help educate people going through that may be confused about all those kind of nitty-gritty things.
Yeah, and that's how we originally connected. I think yes. I asked you to come on the podcast like probably a year ago now. And the day has finally arrived. So yeah, Kristen's Instagram page is amazing, and I'll leave it linked in the show notes. It's I Like My Eggs Fertilized, which I just love that name. And what does it take to become an embryologist? Like if you were like, oh, I want to retrain, or if I wanted to retrain to become an embryologist, what would I have to do?
So you need a science degree. So different countries may have different kind of specific requirements that you may need, but in Australia you need a science degree because the demand for jobs can be quite high when there is a job available. You may even need higher qualifications than that, because if there's one job going, there may be quite a lot of people going for that job. So it does help to have a postgraduate qualification as well, but not everybody does need that. I know some clinics will specify that, yes, they do want like a master's degree, an honours degree, or a PhD. But generally speaking, you should be able to get in with just a science degree.
Oh, that means I could technically become an embryologist if I wanted to, because I already have a science degree.
Oh, that's exciting.
That's great news. That's great. For me, if I ever want a career change. So what do embryologists do? I mean, I feel like embryologists live in the part of the fertility clinic lab where, you know, it's behind closed doors in a lot of ways. And I feel like it isn't until maybe people go through a round of IVF or go through a fertility treatment cycle that they begin to kind of start to appreciate the role of an embryologist. So what is going on behind there? We want to know.
So we're the ones that are in sperm lab and embryology lab. So they're two separate kind of areas. So in the sperm lab, we're the ones that we're doing all the semen analysis. So we're looking at the sperm, we're checking what the concentration is, what the motility is, we're staining the slides and looking at them to assess the morphology. We are preparing samples for IUI, IVF and ICSI. So doesn't matter what that sperm is needed for when you're coming through treatment, that all gets prepared and washed through the sperm lab. And we do freezing, sperm thawing, and all that kind of stuff. In the embryology lab, that's where we do the egg collection. So we get the follicular fluid from the doctor. We search through that to get those eggs out and then move them into their little dishes. We do the embryo transfers. So they're the procedures. And then in terms of just the general embryology stuff, we're moving embryos from, you know, from the fertilization dish to the embryo culture dish. We, you know, wash the little embryos as we're moving them along. We do the freezing and the thawing and updating patients with what's going on with their embryos.
There's so much that embryologists do. And I think it's so great that patients have the opportunity to talk to an embryologist as part of their care because there's so many cool insights that you can share with them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. A lot of people before going through this treatment, they would never, you know, have heard of half of the stuff that, you know, may need to go on. So, yeah, a lot of people are quite either confused or surprised or just have a lot of questions because it's just stuff that they've never come across before.
Yeah, I remember learning about embryology in my degree and I distinctly remember having to memorize exactly what was happening from, you know, the moment of fertilization to I think it was day 12 or something of the embryo's development. And I remember having to learn it and it came up in an exam question and we literally had to draw the diagram of every single day and map it all out from memory. It was a really hard question, but it made me realize how much changes and develops within hours and days. It is absolutely mind-blowing as a science. It's really cool.
So much change.
Yeah. Now, we get this question a lot at The Dietologist from clients across all of our platforms on social media, which is about what is the difference between egg number an egg or egg count, an egg quality. And can you just define the differences for us, Kristen, so our listeners are aware of the
Okay, so when it comes to egg number, so egg number is the number of eggs that we get at egg collection, right? So everybody wants lots and lots of eggs and they want a good number because we do expect a big attrition rate to occur because they're not all going to fertilize and they're not going all to divide on and they're not all going to make an embryo. But having all these egg numbers, having a big egg number means nothing if they're poor quality. So the quality of the egg is what the egg actually looks like. So for example, you may get 20 eggs at egg collection, but they may be poorer quality than somebody that gets 10 eggs. So I've seen cases where people have had, you know, over 20 eggs and their fertilization has actually been very, very low because the quality of the eggs is quite poor. So yeah, everybody kind of, you know, they focus on the number, but really it's the quality that's important.
Quality over quantity. It applies to friends and eggs.
That is correct.
So what are you looking for when it comes to egg quality? Because I get this question a lot about, well, how do I know I have good quality eggs? And they've never done a round of IVF before, or they've never come into contact with a fertility clinic in any way or shape or form. They want to know about their egg quality. Is there a way to know?
No. So with the quality, I'm unsure because I know the AMH does, the AMH test gives an idea of the ovarian reserve, but it doesn't really tell us about the quality. So if somebody hasn't gone through fertility treatment, I'm unsure as to how a doctor would be able to determine they've got poor quality eggs. Mm. However, women that do have an older age or women that have ovarian failure, they are more likely to have poor quality eggs.
Yeah.
That's not all the time. That's not, you know, set in stone, but generally speaking, the older patients and with premature ovarian failure do have poorer quality eggs.
Yeah.
In the lab, we wouldn't really know until we do an ICSI. So we strip the eggs to do the ICSI.
Yeah.
And then we can see that sometimes there's eggs that are grainy, they're dark, they're small, they have a thick zona around the outside, or they're quite pitted, they're quite granular. Otherwise, if we're not doing an ICSI, we would just see the next morning with an IVF check that when we're looking for signs of fertilization, we may note that they appear poor quality. At that stage in time, doesn't necessarily tell us much because we still need to see, we're still going to keep them and see whether they make an embryo. So at the end of the day, what's important is the embryo development and if they're able to make blastocyst.
Yeah. And I think a really common misconception, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think there's this big idea that if fertilization isn't happening, it must be a sperm problem, which is a factor, absolutely. But there's actually a kind of a little communication that's going on between sperm and egg, and almost the egg also has to accept that the sperm is going to fertilize it in the case where you're doing IVF without ICSI. That is actually needs to happen, and that could then be part of, you know, working out if it's an egg quality issue or sperm quality issue. Is that correct?
Yeah. So when we get cases of low fertilization and people ask me like, why has this happened? I can't give them a reason. And I say that could be either sperm issue or egg issue. And in cases of abnormal fertilization, so instead of seeing the two pronuclei, we may see three or four or even more in some random cases. It could be either. It could be that too many sperms gotten in, but the egg hasn't done its job of blocking those extra sperm out, or it hasn't done it. The egg hasn't done its job of releasing its extra set of chromosomes as it should have before it allowed the sperm through. So it can be either. It can definitely be either, but the egg definitely has roles to play in successful fertilization.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the things that sometimes I talk to clients about after they have a cycle, and they're like, what? I didn't know. And I was like, yeah, eggs are quite picky. So from your perspective as an embryologist, Kristen, what can people do to be supporting their egg quality and or quantity?
Okay, so in terms of quantity, you can't do anything because we're born with all of the eggs that we'll ever have, and a lot of people don't know that. So the eggs that we have in our ovaries right now, they are there, they are waiting, and we're not going to make any more of them. So, and some doctors think that's true too in terms of quality as well. They say if you've got poor quality eggs, then, you know, your eggs in there are just poor quality. But what some doctors are finding is that if you are careful through those 3 months before, those 3 months as those eggs are actually maturing, even though they've already been in there, they're in an immature state. So in those 3 months that it takes for them to actually progress through the stage where they're going to be ovulated or taken out during egg collection, they are susceptible to further damage or to antioxidant protection. So I think if people are being as healthy as they can and avoiding toxins, they can potentially get better results. I've seen people come through with really poor eggs, really poor embryo development, then come back a few months later and actually get really nice embryos. So that can either be from lifestyle changes or protocol changes as well, because the doctors can change protocols. And I've definitely seen people get better results.
Yeah. And that aligns quite nicely with what we do at the Dietologists, in terms of we really advocate for that at least minimum that 90-day window where you're going to go from really immature follicle to a potential dominant follicle, whether you're going to ovulate that naturally or you're going to get stimulated and you're going to have lots of dominant follicles. So the egg will eventually become one of the biggest cells, single cells in the whole body. And so it's really like, I always say you want to wrap it in bubble wrap. You want to try and protect it from any further damage and really kind of nourish it as well if you can. And that's all we can control, because we can't change our age and we certainly can't change our DNA. We can change the way our DNA is expressed via epigenetics, but that's all we've got to work with. We can't reverse age ourselves yet. So until somebody invents that technology, we have to just work with what we've got in terms of promoting egg quality.
Yeah. And you can discuss with your doctor if they recommend any specific supplements, because some doctors, depending on what a patient's cause of infertility are, they may recommend certain things like DHEA or growth hormone or CoQ10. And so do discuss with your doctor if there's anything they do recommend. I know not all doctors have things that they think will make a difference. I've spoken to doctors and they've just kind of said, no, your eggs are the way they are. But then I know that there's other doctors that will prescribe certain things to help with egg quality. So it's worth definitely asking and just seeing what they do think may be worth trying.
Yeah. And I think especially for people that maybe are having one more crack with their own eggs for an IVF cycle before considering something like donor eggs, for example, they want to throw everything at it and give it a good crack. And, you know, we do, we even design those kinds of supplement protocols for people. We don't do DHEA or growth hormones and stuff like that because that would interfere with the medical side. But things like CoQ10 and those are really safe and regular kind of things that we can do that may have a benefit based on the data.
Perfect.
Awesome. So now thinking about sperm quality, what do you see in the lab and what do you notice about men's habits, either lifestyle or otherwise, that may impact sperm?
So a lot of the time when we're getting men come through and they've got poor quality sperm, like I don't know why because I don't really have any information about, you know, their lifestyle. I will have information about they will record down their weight or supplements or medication that they're on, but I really don't get an idea of what kind of, you know, I don't know what job they are, if they're working with toxins or paints or chemicals, or if they're doing FIFO and they're up on the mines in really hot environments that may be affecting them. But what's really important that the data does show is for a male to be of a healthy weight, being overweight absolutely does cause sperm issues and fertilization issues as well, from what I've read. You want the male to be as healthy as possible, a healthy weight, and avoiding those toxins and heat and chemicals if they're working with any chemicals. Alcohol, smoking, and drugs, you're obviously wanting to cut that out. Alcohol, you know, discuss with your doctor, but at least reduce that. Smoking does induce oxidative damage to the sperm. So we just want to be as healthy as possible in terms of our diet and antioxidants, because some causes of poor sperm quality are from low antioxidants. One of the things that a lot of people don't know, if they are having fertility issues, they may or may not have had their DNA fragmentation tested, because not all doctors will test that, and that may not be a thing that needs to be tested right at the start. But just in terms of sperm health and DNA of the sperm, you want to be keeping the sperm fresh, which means don't have a big period of abstinence. So don't wait for a week leading up to ovulation thinking you need to save those sperm up, because what you're doing is those sperm are just left there waiting. And while they're waiting, they're just being exposed to all sorts of things that can damage them. So you need to keep those sperm fresh, which means you need to be increasing the frequency of ejaculation. So in men that have known high DNA fragmentation, we will tell them to have almost daily ejaculation to keep those sperm as fresh as possible.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because I often hear a lot of clients telling their male partner to like save it up. And yeah, my understanding was the same as what you were saying, was that the longer it's there, the longer it's got time to be exposed to potential toxins or potential damages. So that's interesting that you mentioned that. I find that really fascinating. I've seen some really wild sperm analysis turnarounds in clients that do make some significant lifestyle changes. And the good news is because of that, unlike women, right, that we are born with all the eggs we ever have, men aren't born with all the sperm they'll ever have. They're kind of in a regenerative kind of cycle of about 74 days, right? So yeah, we've got the opportunity to potentially turn things around in just a few short months. Yes. And support sperm counts and concentration and motility and morphology and all that good stuff, and as well DNA fragmentation. And we can't do that same analysis of DNA fragmentation on the sperm as we could the egg, right?
Yeah.
We're not going to bust open an egg and work out all the DNA, because it's too too much of a precious resource. There's not millions and jillions of them like sperm, right?
I know.
Precious, precious eggs.
Yes.
So, Kristen, as people's IVF journeys unfold, we often start to learn more about what might not be working for them. For example, we've talked a little bit about fertilization, maturity sometimes, blastocyst development, implantation. How does this change the approach as the fertility team in the lab and or in the clinic? Obviously, you can speak from your embryologist perspective. Like, how does that change? Because sometimes I speak to clients and they're like, okay, so now we have this information, but I feel like something has to change now that we know that this information. So what are some of the things that you might start thinking about in these scenarios?
Yeah, so it's interesting, because a lot of people don't realize that there's so many so many different areas where things could potentially not go to plan. I think people think when they're paying for IVF, they're just going to pay for some really nice embryos and they're going to have all these shots at pregnancy, that they don't realize that you could actually get poor fertilization, poor embryo development, or even with a really good embryo, it might not work. So the first thing that I see is egg numbers. So a lot of people will be very disappointed with the number of eggs that they get. So if somebody's had poor stimulation but it's their first cycle, there's definitely things that doctors can try for their next round where they could. I've had a friend of mine that came through, got two eggs her first cycle, did get a baby from that, which is important to know. Low egg number isn't necessarily a bad thing. But then when she came back for her second child, I think she got about 18 eggs. So she did a lot better because the doctor knew how she responded to the original protocol. He was able to change that because you can change the dosage and you can change the drug. There's lots of different protocols that can be tried. With poor fertilization, we can, if somebody's just come through with normal sperm and normal eggs, then we put them through for standard IVF, which is just we add the sperm to the eggs and leave them alone. If that results in poor fertilization, then we'll say, okay, next time we're going to try something different. We're going to do ICSI. So this is where we strip the eggs of all their fluffy cells and we take a sperm, inject it in. With poor embryo development, we're trying to get them to go to day 5 blastocyst stage, but that's not going very well, then next time we can say, well, we'll try day 3. So some clinics do offer both. I'm lucky that I work at a clinic that offers both, and I'm grateful that I am, because a lot of people just won't have embryos that do well in the lab to day 5, but get pregnant from day 3 transfers, because you're putting the embryo back into its natural environment. It's going to be a lot happier than in an artificial environment. So that's probably the main things, is the fertilization and the embryo development. And then in terms of egg maturity, so that's more of a medical issue for the doctors. So girls with PCOS a lot of the time can have a higher number of immature eggs. So a different stimulation protocol may help, especially if they're not getting as many eggs. So a lot of girls with PCOS, quite common to get high egg numbers, and then with that high number of immature eggs, if we can make them kind of have a less stimulation, less eggs, hopefully we've got a better amount that's good quality mature eggs.
Awesome. And that is such useful information for people, mm-hmm. because I think a lot of people really struggle to unpack that kind of information that they get sometimes from their clinic. So it's good to know that there's different things to consider and different pathways to take. Thinking now, Kristen, about embryo grading. What is it? How does it work? How is it done? And should everyone be getting their embryos graded as a standard, or is that happening as a standard, or is it only happening in some circumstances?
So from what I understand, it happens as standard. So it helps the embryologist choose which embryo has the highest implantation potential. So even though some clinics won't tell you as much information, they're probably still doing it and they're still writing it down, but they may not tell you. So when you go to have your embryo transfer, a lot of clinics, they'll give you a photo. They'll say, this is the grade of your embryo. Some clinics won't do that. They just say, you know, you have an embryo for transfer today. And I understand why they're doing that, because they don't want people to stress out about it. But I like to tell the patients, I like to show them, this is your photo, this is the grade of your embryo, and these are the embryos that we have that are suitable for putting in the freezer later. So when we're talking about grading, we're talking about the morphology of the egg, so just what it looks like. So with a day 3 embryo, we're looking at how many cells are in there, what kind of quality those cells are, if they're even size, if they're all the same size, or if they're uneven, or if there's a little bit of fragmentation present. So lots of labs will have their own individual grading system. But for example, if I get a beautiful 8-cell embryo, all the cells are nice and even and there's no fragmentation, I'd give that a grade 1. If I've got some cells that, you know, they're a little bit uneven, I'd give it a grade 2, and a heavily fragmented embryo, I'd give a grade 3 or a grade 4, just depending on the severity of it. with a blastocyst, a day five embryo. We're grading the inner cell mass, which is the blob in the middle, and then the trophectoderm cells around the outside. So I do that on an ABC scale. A lot of labs do that, but I've seen lots of different systems as well. So I'd give a really beautiful big inner cell mass that's tightly compacted. I'd give that a grade A. And trophectoderm, if there's lots of layers of plump trophectoderm, I'd give that a grade A. But if it's kind of like a smaller, looser cell, inner cell mass, that would be a B. No inner cell mass or very thin and degraded is a C. And likewise for the trophectoderm, the poorer quality it gets, I'd decide whether it's a B or a C. So in terms of, opting for it, the lab should really kind of do it as standard. And if they haven't told you, you're more than welcome to ask, just say, do you have any information about my embryo that you can give me, if they haven't just come forth with anything for you.
So it's a visual assessment under the microscope.
It is
happening. And yes. What's the, this is my science brain, what's the congruence between two embryologists in the same lab? Are you pretty consistent in, if I give this a grade one or a grade A, the next embryologist says the same thing?
Yes,
is that pretty high?
Yeah, so obviously grading is subjective, but we all get monitored quite closely. We do quality assurance, quality control programs that ensure that we are very similar with how we grade.
That's so cool. I love nerdy stuff like that. that was a selfish question for me, everyone.
Oh, sorry. And also, some labs, which I haven't had experience with this yet, but I hope to soon, is that some labs also use artificial intelligence in conjunction with the morphology.
Yep.
So it's got a computer system that will have a look at the time-lapse image and we'll give it a grade called a kid score, or I think there's a few different scores now, and they will use that in conjunction with the morphology to give it a grade.
Okay, hence the why we get sometimes those two-letter grades, AA and BAs and all that different stuff.
Yeah, so I think, I'm unsure how they add in the time-lapse ones, but, you get the two letters for AA or AB, that's for the inner cell mass and the trophectoderm.
Got you. Perfect. Thanks so much for clearing that up, because I get so many questions about that and I'm always like, why don't you just call the embryologist and I'm sure they'll explain it to you.
And we love explaining it. Do call us, because we love talking about this stuff.
I know. Every scientist loves to communicate what they're finding in their science, of course.
Exactly.
So what's the difference between that process we just talked about, which let's call embryo grading, versus genetically testing the embryo?
Yes, good question. So as I said, the grading is just based on looking at the embryo. So looking at the embryo, we'll give it a grade, but that tells us nothing about what's going on inside of the embryo. So when we're talking about genetic testing, we're talking about literally the chromosomal profile. So what we're able to do is biopsy an embryo once it gets to the day five stage, pluck off a couple of those cells and or four to five cells and send them off, and then they will get their DNA tested to see what the chromosomal profile is. So we can see which ones are genetically normal and which ones are genetically abnormal.
And what are the pros and cons of that process in terms of genetically testing an embryo? We understand it's plucking off a few cells. Is that from the trophectoderm or from the inner cell?
Yes.
Okay. From the trophectoderm layer. And then I have all sorts of questions that come flying around in consultations around genetic testing, the pros, the cons, they're thinking about it, they're torn about it. From a science perspective, what does that kind of look like?
Yeah, so from a science perspective, I think it's an amazing thing to do if your doctor has suggested that it is for you, because it is not going to be for everyone. Not everybody needs it, and most people will get pregnant without it. So, I mean, if you carry a genetic disease, for example, then yes, absolutely, you're going to want to take those risks and the risks that are involved with biopsy or testing and have your embryos tested. If you are an older patient, then, you're probably going to want to take those risks as well. If your doctor has said, look, you've had a few unsuccessful transfers or you've had a few losses, we need to look at testing, then I think it's an amazing thing that can be done, especially where patients are getting, lots of good embryos. By getting them tested, what we see a lot of the time is that we've got our list of embryos, and what we usually would have chosen for transfer first, those ones, once we get those genetic testing results, they're just taken out of the pool. They're not going to be normal. They're taken out. And even those really good, high-quality embryos, they can be genetically abnormal.
Yeah.
So in a lot of circumstances, it's great. However, people need to know that there are risks involved. There's a small chance of damage to the embryo. There's a chance that it may not survive the freezing process and the thawing process. And there are chances that there may be issues with the results. So you may get told your embryo is abnormal when in reality it was just, it's a mosaic embryo that had abnormal cells that were taken off at biopsy, mm-hmm. Or the other way around. I've seen beautiful euploid embryos that haven't survived the thaw, and that just makes me think, oh my goodness, if that wasn't a biopsied embryo and it hadn't been frozen, maybe it would have survived. So in Australia, we're lucky where we have these kind of restrictions in place where you can't just off the bat go, yep, I'm having all my embryos tested first go. And like I said, a lot of people will find they have success quite quickly without needing to do that. In America, from what I see, a lot of people are encouraged quite early on that their best chance is to have their embryos genetically tested. And I see why the doctors say that, because they are getting a high chance of pregnancy with tested embryos. But I just think it's important that people know that they may not need it and they don't necessarily have to put their embryos through the biopsy process. Like if I was coming through as an IVF patient, I'd kind of be like, oh, yeah, I wouldn't be rushing off to get my embryos tested unless my doctor strongly recommended it.
Okay, cool. So it's all about finding the right fit for the right situation in terms of
that. With any kind of add-on in the lab, anything that's different in the lab, I think it's best to all be done on a case-by-case situation. Nothing with fertility treatment is black and white.
No. We have learned that. Yes. Absolutely. It's a lot of grey area and it's a big sliding scale. And as well, I think for some people it's preferences as well and different, like from a non-sciencey perspective, a lot of people feel certain ways about genetic testing of embryos and so on. So, I think all those things need to be taken into account as well, not just the medical science perspective, which was what I asked you, but I also wanted to acknowledge there's other components to having a think about whether genetically testing embryos is for you.
Exactly.
What is one, maybe to three things you wish you could tell people who are going through fertility treatments as an embryologist that you would just love to pass on as words of wisdom, Kristen?
Okay, words of wisdom. So if you get to the stage where you've actually got a nice embryo for transfer, don't get focused on the grading, because poor embryos can fail and really good embryos aren't guaranteed to work. So if you get there for your embryo transfer and they tell you, oh, you know, it's okay, it's a BB, don't get stressed for your whole 2-week wait that it's not an A grade embryo, because we're still getting lots of pregnancies from average embryos and even poor embryos, and they're not going to transfer something that they don't think has a chance. So I see a lot of patients get really stressed and focused on what the actual grade is, but I just need people to know that it's not something you need to obsess over, because the chance is what it is, and it doesn't matter if I tell you it's an A or a B, just that embryo is going to be in there and it needs to find its way and make a home, and there's nothing that, don't feel that you've done something wrong if that hasn't worked. That's probably my main thing, is that I just see so many people stressing out about that, and I think that that's unnecessary.
I think as well that speaks a lot to, I think, a lot of the terminology, like just around the fact that we're grading an embryo like it's getting a report card, like you're in school and you have to work hard to get a certain grade, and it's like, it's really not got all that much to do with how hard you worked at it. It's just, it is what it is in the lab, and that's how it goes. And like you said, genetic normality isn't necessarily correlated with embryo grade either. So, you know, you could be sweating bullets over a certain grade, but in fact it's genetically normal and maybe has a better chance than the one that looks better grade. And, do you know what I mean?
Exactly,
so
right.
You just never know how it's going to unfold. And so you know, giving each one a potential chance and viewing them in that way is sometimes helpful for people to kind of manage their anxiety.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's such a challenging part of the like the journey of IVF is all these little things that come into play.
Yes.
So, Kristen, thank you so much for joining us on Fertility Friendly Food. Now, if people want to connect with you, where can they find you?
Yep, so you can find me on Instagram at I Like My Eggs Fertilized, and that's with an S because I'm in Australia. And, yeah, feel free to flick me a message if you have any questions.
Yes, we absolutely love Kristen's page at the Diet. I'm always going over there and checking out what's going on. So we love your Instagram page. So thank you for doing it outside of your, you know, usual work responsibilities. It's a big job. So really appreciate it. And, yeah, thanks again for joining us. All right, everyone, thank you so much for joining us for this episode. Don't forget to leave a rating and review in Apple Podcasts, hit subscribe or follow on your favorite podcasting platform, and I will catch you next time. Bye.